loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Will U.S.-China relations reach a boiling point under the Donald Trump administration? Anti-China hawk Peter Navarro is heading up a new National Trade Council. As Trump himself has said, he doesn't think that the United States should necessarily be bound by the one China policy that dates back almost four decades. How have relations between Washington and Beijing reached this degree of turbulence? We'll examine how the ascendancy of China on the world stage has altered global politics as U.S. hegemony finds itself challenged. We are joined from London by Keith Bennett. He is a researcher and analyst on Chinese politics and international relations. He works as an advisor with both Chinese and Western companies. He has worked for the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding and has visited China literally hundreds of times, first in April 1981. We are also joined by David Ewing. He is the chairperson or co-chair of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Welcome, Keith and David.
Thank you. Nice to be back.
Nice to be back indeed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. Thank you both for joining. Let's talk about, again, just to get started, the unexpected, Donald Trump having won the presidency. Well, that was unexpected. But what was also unexpected, and certainly I didn't expect it, I don't know if you did or if others did, was the sharp rhetoric that immediately began coming out of Donald Trump's office and out of his mouth in regard to and out of his Twitter regarding China. He said, of course, he first took a call from the leader of Taiwan. That turned out to be a well-planned call, not a casual congratulations, as he first tried to, you know, sort of pretend. That was well prepared. The Heritage Foundation was involved in that. He then went on to criticize China harshly and then ultimately said, well, we should not be bound by the one China policy, which, of course, is the anchor or the bedrock, the foundation for U.S.-China bilateral relations for the past four decades. Keith Bennett, when you see or hear Donald Trump's pronouncements, do you believe that in China the leadership is getting ready for a new stage of U.S.-China relations, something more confrontational, even more confrontational than Obama's Asia pivot?
I think undoubtedly they are. At first, I think the Chinese leadership were prepared to give Trump the benefit of the doubt, to forgive him, if you like, for some of his rhetoric on the campaign trail, and to see how he actually performed in office. But with the constant barrage of tweets against China since he became the president-elect, and with his appointments, particularly of Navarro, and the phone call with the leader of Taiwan, these things will have the leadership in Beijing very worried. I was in China in October, and I was talking with some people from the Communist Party there about the prospects of the U.S. presidential election. And what they said was, well, first of all, they were, to put it mildly, not enamored of either leading candidate. They said that Hillary Clinton, so far as they were concerned, was an enemy of China, someone who was hostile to them, but she was at least a known quantity. As they put it, that we know how she wants to deal with us, and we know how to deal with her. With Trump, there was this question of uncertainty and instability, and whether at home or abroad, instability is the thing that the Chinese leadership fears most, because it wants stability in order to develop the country.
Yes, I hear you on that. And one of the things, David Ewing, is that the first call that Donald Trump made with Xi Jinping, both leaders said the call went well, that
yes,
they talked about mutual respect. In other words, Donald Trump sort of said the right things. But Donald Trump always says the right thing in the beginning. In other words, that's his style. He says, let's be friends. We love you. You love me. Blah, blah, blah. But then you never know what's coming next. And what came next from Trump was really a clear indication that there is going to be a profoundly different policy towards China. It's not accidental. It wasn't incidental. It wasn't one time. It wasn't isolated. There's been pronouncement after pronouncement after pronouncement. And it's deep now within the Republican Party. I even participated in a debate with two right-wing Republican officials or media hangers-on who were important people. And they were virulent in their rhetoric against China. One of them was against Russia, too. The other was for normalizing relations with Russia. But both were united in their virulence against China and said, China is the reason that the United States is going down, so to speak, and that we have to reverse that issue. We have to stop China's rise. I mean, that's what, in essence, they were saying. Go ahead.
You know, in a way, I am reassured in the last few days. The bluster we're hearing from President-elect Trump is directed not only at China, but now even at Putin, right? There are some announcements that the U.S. was going to greatly enlarge the, you know, first strike into the capacity it already has over Russia. So there's these kind of like wild kind of things that he says. So maybe the things that he says about China aren't, you know, are just part of this pattern of bluster. And then I think a couple things to worry about if you're Mr. Trump are, first, you have to think about the capacity of the United States. How many countries right now can the U.S. take on? And his immediate promise, I think Mr. Trump's immediate promises seem to be focused on the Middle East. So he's going to destroy ISIS, and he has fantasies about doing that strictly with military aircraft. So that's going to be a lot for him to tackle, and it's on his plate immediately. So I'm in a paradoxical way, maybe I'm a little reassured by his most recent crazy statements that perhaps we shouldn't give as much weight to last week's, 2 weeks ago's crazy statement. So who knows?
Well, Keith Bennett, what about that idea that because Donald Trump's sort of vituperative rhetoric is against many, not just one, that perhaps that's a saving grace for China? I'm not sure China will see it that way, because China, of course, is mainly thinking, what does this mean for us? Go ahead.
I think there's a certain merit in that point of view. And I think one of the things where, at least until very recently, why the Chinese were perhaps relatively sanguine about Trump is that they feel that there's a pretty well-established U.S. political routine. As somebody once put it to me, that all U.S. presidential candidates are hostile to China, and all U.S. presidents, after a while, look to build relations with China. And there was some kind of thought that Trump would also fit into this pattern. And there's also the pattern that when a U.S. president comes in, you often have a period of tension in China-U.S. relations, and then they settle down. We saw it in the mid-1990s with Bill Clinton and the Chinese military exercises in the Taiwan Straits, where Clinton sent the U.S. fleet to warn down China, and China at that stage was militarily less capable of responding to that than it is now. With George W. Bush, we had the incident where the Chinese pilot, there was a confrontation in the skies. A Chinese pilot, Wang Wei, was killed. A crew of over 20 U.S. service personnel were forced down and held on China's Hainan Island for several weeks before they were returned home. And their aircraft was then later returned by China over a period of time and in pieces to the U.S. And then they settled down. And one of the reasons, indeed, why they have settled down is that a lot of U.S. presidents have expressed a desire to get away from a fixation with the Middle East. George W. Bush said that, campaigned after all as being somebody who was not greatly in favor of intervention. Obama wanted to have his pivot because he saw Iraq as a dumb war, and he wanted to be more focused on the Middle East. But nevertheless, U.S. presidents find themselves forced back towards the Middle East, which enables China, Russia, and other countries to get on with their job of nation building. So there may be some merit in that. What's different about it is that one could talk. I mean, Trump is very easy with the rhetoric, and one could perhaps take that with a degree of skepticism. But when you put it together with the appointment, not just of Navarro, but with the whole State Department and security teams, then I think we're into a more worrying scenario. And we shouldn't forget that the quadrillennial Pentagon defense reviews have for a long time identified China as the number one potential adversary and threat to U.S. hegemony in the long run.
Go ahead, David.
You know, I think to a large degree, Trump's policy towards China will be driven by his economic policies within the U.S. So the main function of the anti-China rhetoric during his election campaign was to blame Chinese imports, many of which, of course, come to American companies, but to blame Chinese imports for the loss of American manufacturing jobs. And his promise, and, you know, he tried to appeal to the working-class base with the promise that he would restore high-paying working-class industrial jobs to the United States. Now, I don't think that that's possible because I think jobs are actually replaced by robots, not by Chinese workers. So we have, the productivity of labor is just so much higher now than it was in the 1980s. We are not going to build automotive plants that employ thousands of workers anymore. They're going to employ hundreds of robots instead. But anyway, this threat of a trade war with China was part of his popular appeal, and it's something a little worrisome that he keeps repeating. So to make China the bad guy is to make China the bad guy on these trade issues, and it's a target that can take pressure off his political regime if things don't work out the way he expects them to. And that's where the danger of a bigger conflict with China might emerge.
Keith Bennett, when Ronald Reagan came into office in 1981, and I would say Ronald Reagan was the most right-wing president in that period for the United States. Donald Trump is like Ronald Reagan in the sense that it was kind of a shocking move to the right, sort of a sharp departure to the right. And when Reagan came in, Reagan and his advisor said, we're gonna stop the communist winning streak, meaning the loss in Vietnam and Cambodia and Laos and Ethiopia, Angola, Mozambique, Guinea-Bissau, Nicaragua, you know, Afghanistan, et cetera, et cetera. In other words, where the United States was losing big parts of the empire to socialist revolutions or national liberation movements that were aligned with the USSR, they said, we're going to stop the communist winning streak. And there was an escalation of rhetoric and then an arms race directed against the Soviet Union. It was called in some circles the full court press. And it was considered by the Soviets extremely dangerous, and it became extremely expensive for the Soviets because they wanted to match the U.S. military escalation with their own military escalation. It certainly led to a lot of tensions inside the socialist bloc countries that eventually burst apart at the end of the 1980s. And there was the overthrow, finally, of the socialist governments in Eastern and Central Europe. And then, shocking to everyone at that time, the overthrow of the Soviet government. In other words, there was regime change. Around the same time, during the same period, Ronald Reagan and his team had been friends with China as part of an anti-Soviet alliance. They were friends with the government in China against the Soviet Union. But then in 1989, at the same time that there were big protests in Eastern and Central Europe, there was a big protest at Tiananmen Square, a long 7-week-long protest by students and others. And it became quite clear then that under those circumstances, the U.S. government that had treated China as a friend against the Soviet Union was also looking for regime change in China. And of course, the Chinese government suppressed those mobilizations and the government was not overthrown. But I'm wondering, Keith, whether you think, and this is just a possibility, whether Donald Trump and his advisors believe that a full court press against the PRC, against the People's Republic of China, could have the same kind of impact. In other words, are they possibly even looking for regime change in Beijing?
I think obviously, long term, the United States will be looking for regime change, looking to try and secure regime change in China or in any other socialist country or anti-imperialist country that maintains its independence. Whether or not they can bring it about is another thing. In that context, I think those tweets of Trump were quite interesting when he supposedly said about a nuclear arms race of saying bring it on. Now, so far as I'm concerned, the only other nuclear power with which one can remotely talk about the United States having a nuclear arms race is Russia, because Russia is the only country whose nuclear arsenal is remotely comparable to that of the United States. All the other nuclear powers, including China, have nuclear arsenals that, in comparison to the US, are essentially puny. So it's interesting to try and find out whether that remark was in fact directed at Russia, whether the so-called romance with Russia is actually over long before it was even consummated, or because Trump's not always necessarily the best informed person in the world, whether he thinks it's directed at China. The point about this is China will certainly be increasing its defense spending, as it has been doing for several years now, although it's remotely nowhere near that of the United States. But China has also looked very closely and very carefully at of what they see as the causes of the collapse of the USSR. And one thing they will not do is actually allow themselves to be drawn into an arms race that they cannot win, that they cannot hope to win, and that will bleed their economy dry. They won't go down that road.
Okay, that's Keith Bennett. We're talking to him from London. We're also talking to David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We're talking for the full hour about China, China, and U.S. relations in the year 2017 coming up. Again, the United States under the leadership of Donald Trump. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined for the full hour and for a discussion about China and U.S.-China relations by Keith Bennett. We're talking to him from London. He is a researcher and analyst on Chinese politics and international relations. He advises both Chinese and Western companies. He has worked for the Society for Anglo-Chinese Understanding and has visited China hundreds of times, first in April 1981. We're also joined by David Ewing from California. He is the chair of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. David Ewing, before we went to break, we were talking about the fundamental long-term objects or goals of U.S. foreign policy towards China. Of course, there's more than one goal. But what I was asking Keith Bennett and asking you was whether it was possible that, given the fact that the United States has tried to carry out regime change against independent governments, nationalist governments, socialist governments, governments that are, again, fundamentally not proxies or puppets of the United States, if there were to be instability in China, if there were to be social strife or class strife, if there were to be like the reemergence of a protest movement, such as what happened in Tiananmen Square in 1989, certainly the Trump administration would feel like that was complete vindication. That's hard to imagine in one way because there's such an intertangling of U.S. and Chinese economies, and the outcome of a major instability in China could very much harm U.S. corporate elites and U.S. corporate investments. And at the same time, there is this overarching sort of political counter-revolutionary function of the U.S. government that always seeks vulnerabilities in governments that are, again, independent and seeks to overthrow them if the opportunity arises.
Yes, you know, I think long-term, if you look at the classic, I think Hillary Clinton, President Obama, were people who took a longer-term view of destroying Chinese socialism. They saw it, and they see China in a strategic sense, that it's a powerful, developing country. It's nearing the U.S. in terms of its economic influence, and it will surpass the U.S. at some point. So I think that people who have a strategic view of China, they see it as the sooner that you go after China militarily, the better your chance of winning, and the more you prolong it, the stronger China gets. And I think that might be the reason for the pivot and the aggression under the Obama government towards China. But is this consistent with the America First policy of the new president? You know, he has said so many different things during the campaign, but my sense is there is a certain isolationist pragmatism to his policy towards maybe even towards China. So his focus, I think, may be more on domestic problems. He has said that the U.S. economy has suffered a calamity under the Democrats, and he's actually promised a $1 trillion infrastructure program. $1 trillion is still a significant amount of money, even in terms of today's giant budgets. $1 trillion for that, $1 trillion for the arms race, you know, that's, you know, we're running into several trillions now. How much is there to challenge China? So I think he will be driven by domestic concerns, and whether these are enough to trump the strategic view that the U.S. has had toward China or not, I'm not sure. But he has to decide between, will he embrace the neocon strategy of going after China, or will he adopt a more independent America First policy? And I don't know yet, but I'm hopeful he might not embrace the neocon war policies.
Keith Bennett, regime change happens not simply because the U.S. has a conspiracy to overthrow governments. There also has to be sort of inherent foundational discontent or struggle within the targeted country. We could see in Libya, for instance, the United States was perfectly happy with Gaddafi following his turn towards the embrace of neoliberal policies. But as soon as there was a protest movement that they could latch onto, they did, and they did with a vengeance. And then it was all about Gaddafi must go. Same with Saddam Hussein in Iraq. Again, it was the same, I thought, with Deng Xiaoping in China. And then as soon as the protest movement arose in China, they, you know, the U.S. government focused on it. In other words, it wasn't simply a conspiracy. There also had to be internal strife. And I'm wondering, because the Chinese government must think the same thing, that even though the U.S. may not be hell-bent on regime change, that if an opportunity arose, they would go for it. Talk about Xi Jinping's policies, both the anti-corruption campaign and the efforts to sort of strengthen the communist roots of the Chinese Communist Party, even after all of this opening up and the reintroduction of capitalist property relations, the going back to the Mao era, the Mao slogans, the ethos of the Mao period of egalitarianism, even in this obviously class-divided society. Is Xi Jinping doing this because of a political sort of proclivity, or is it defensive in character? In other words, an effort to kind of batten down the hatches and make China more stable in the face of what could be a hostile international environment?
That's a very interesting question. And I just say that the two aspects that you posed in that question towards the end, I wouldn't necessarily see as being in contradiction with one another. The question of the anti-corruption campaign, I think, is hugely important. First of all, one of the reasons why the Kuomintang government fell, that's the party that was in power before the founding of the People's Republic in 1949, one of the things that made it ripe for falling was that it became totally eroded by corruption and therefore lost popular support, not only among the workers and peasants, but among intellectuals and members of the national bourgeoisie and so on. And obviously, since the beginning of the reform and an opening up period at the end of 1978, amongst the very many things that have happened in that time, one of the things that's happened has been a huge growth in corruption. And right back to the leaders towards the end of the 1980s, the leaders of the Communist Party have been saying that corruption was a life and death issue, determining whether the People's Republic would survive, whether the Communist Party would continue to be in power. And that's not just hyperbole, it's quite real. And discontent over corruption and also at the time inflation was one of the things that initially at least spoke to the Tiananmen Square protests in 1989. So every Chinese leader for the last 25 or more years has said that this question of corruption is a life and death issue. And yet corruption, after some efforts early in their period of office, this corruption has continued and it's become worse. What's different about Xi Jinping's campaign against corruption is that it has been relentless and remorseless and continuous, and it shows no signs of abating. And this is probably the greatest single thing that, in my opinion, makes Xi Jinping extraordinarily popular among the masses of Chinese people. Now, in terms of the other part of your question, as you said, Xi Jinping has repopularized a lot of the Mao era phrases and slogans and concepts about serving the people, about promoting socialist values, and so on. And I think you have to look at Xi Jinping's own background for this, in that both his parents were Long March veterans. His mother was one of the very few women communists who survived that period. His father was an important guerrilla leader before the People's Republic was founded, and later held posts up to the post of vice premier. So even though Xi Jinping's father was actually in political disgrace for a considerable period of Mao's leadership, nevertheless, in his own personal background, he is heavily invested in the People's Republic and the ideals on which it was founded.
David Ewing, I want to ask you a little bit of the same question. It's perplexing from a traditional Marxist or socialist point of view that you have a social system that's led by the Communist Party. It had a planned economy, more or less planned. It had public, all ownership of the basic means of production were public ownership. Starting in the late 1970s and certainly in the 1980s and 1990s, there was the opening up to foreign Western companies and direct foreign investment, but there was also a large degree of privatization and the development in China of a capitalist class, but still the Communist Party was the ruling party. So it had something different. It was almost like a two-way house, like something that had partly capitalist, partly socialist. The Chinese called it a socialism with Chinese characteristics. What is that? What is socialism with Chinese characteristics?
Well, I think that at the end of the Mao period, after Mao's death, as you know, there was a sharp political struggle in the Chinese Communist Party to determine a way forward. I think the best scholarship shows that the economy was still moving ahead, but it was not moving ahead very quickly. And China faced a pretty hostile environment of isolation and even threats from countries that should have been allies, like, for example, the Soviet Union. But they faced a very hostile international environment. So the party made the analysis that in 1970, what we had by 1978 was that if you look at the whole Chinese economy, that relations of production, the socialist relations of production, had run ahead of the productive forces. So in other words, that the government had built a system of socialism, but it was built on a very weak economic base. And to make that base stronger was the way to save the revolution. That's what I think Deng Xiaoping's viewpoint was. And the mechanism they used to do that was comparative advantage. The comparative advantage that the Chinese working class had, it's better educated than other developing countries. It has better health care than workers in other developing countries. It has a better education system, has a better infrastructure. And so the Chinese government was able to use these advantages, these comparative advantages, to rapidly develop China's economy. Part of that, though, of course, as you mentioned, was that there was a concession to private property to do that. China simply did not have the capital resources to do it on its own. It had to invite foreign capitalists to invest. But unlike other countries, other developing countries, other, you know, Asian tigers, China always retained control over the investments. So you might be able to invest in Chinese companies, but you had to agree to give the rights to the industrial processes at some point. They had to revert to China. So China ended up actually owning its own economy instead of the U.S. owning it all. And the technology transfers went directly into the Chinese economy and helped build on the development of the economy. And so now we have not only a large industrial economy, but also a sophisticated one. So that was the gamble, and that was the good part of what has happened. But the bad part, the dangerous part, the part that Xi Jinping, I think, is confronting now, is that the social power of private wealth is a very real phenomenon in China. It's as though there are two centers of power. There is the undoubted political power of the Communist Party of China and the class of workers and peasants that it represents. That power is real, and they demonstrate it every few months by executing a capitalist who steals state property. You'll never see that happen in the U.S., trust me.
No, but by itself, executing a capitalist every few months won't actually stop the impact of capitalist property relations. I mean, it might make a good headline. Keith Bennett, I want to come back to you about the same question, but let's talk about the Chinese model. They say it's socialism with Chinese characteristics. Now, in many ways, it looks very familiar to what the Soviets introduced in 1921, the New Economic Policy, NEP. That was introduced by Lenin following the period that was called War Communism. And Lenin and that wing of the Bolshevik Party at that time said, we don't have the material wherewithal really to build socialism. We have to build up the economy by any means necessary. But the easiest mean was to invite foreign direct investment and allow capital to form. In other words, allow people through the exercise of profit making to revive the economy. And it was wildly successful in 1921 until 1927, 28, when the NEP was basically rescinded. Now, Lenin described that policy as a retreat from socialism. The Chinese are not saying this is a retreat from socialism. The Chinese are saying this is socialism, but with Chinese characteristics. We have about 90 seconds, and then we're going to pick the topic back up after we come back from break. Go ahead.
Right. Well, I think if you look at the Chinese talk about socialism with Chinese characteristics, but the other phrase they use is the primary stage of socialism. So they're very clear that this is a first stage of socialism. It is very far from fully developed socialism, let alone communism. It's true that unlike Lenin, both with NEP and with the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk with Germany, where Lenin was always very clear about identifying where something was a concession or a retreat, for whatever reason, people don't seem to do that anymore. But it doesn't mean to say that this is not what it is in essence.
That's right. Okay, so that was Keith Bennett. We're talking with Keith Bennett. He is in London. He's a researcher and analyst on Chinese politics and international relations. He advises both Chinese and Western companies doing business in China. We're also talking with David Ewing. He is the co-chair of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We're talking about U.S.-China relations as we go into the year 2017 with Donald Trump about to ascend to the White House. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. We're joined for the full hour from London by Keith Bennett. He is a researcher and analyst on Chinese politics and international relations. We're also joined by David Ewing. He is the chairperson or co-chair of the San Francisco branch of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We're talking about U.S.-China relations, the internal political and social dynamics within China, and what a Trump White House will mean for U.S. relations, big term, long term, and of course, the implications for China in its other relations internationally with Russia, with India, with Brazil, in other words, with the BRICS countries. Keith Bennett, we were talking to you about the NEP and its impact or the NEP-type economic model in China, what the Chinese call socialism with Chinese characteristics. That's a big topic, and I'd like to go back to it. But before we do that, I want to talk about what's likely to happen in 2017, because we're looking forward here at the end of the year. During the Obama administration, there was the rise of what's called BRICS. That is an alliance between Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, emerging countries or large-scale countries, large-scale economies that were not part of the United States alliance, not part of NATO. In other words, a counter-hegemonic front in a way. Of course, that alliance has been dented in some ways with the overthrow of the government in Brazil, the Workers' Party government, the Dilma Rousseff government, and its replacement by Michel Temer, who is a neoliberal conservative orienting really towards the United States rather than the BRICS countries. But BRICS is unlike the socialist bloc alliances, too, because each of the countries sees in the other or in the others the possibility for a pragmatic relationship to counter the pressures from the West, from the United States and NATO. But they also have their own differences and their own divergences. And of course, we know that specifically in terms of China-India relations. But Keith Bennett, just for a little bit, as we go forward, when we see 2017 shaping up as a year in which the United States government led by Trump will be more confrontational with China, it may be less confrontational both with Russia and with India in particular, and of course, less so with Brazil now that Brazil is led by a right-wing government. Talk about the prospects for BRICS under these circumstances.
First of all, I think the whole BRICS concept still has great vitality and great prospects, but that doesn't mean to say that it won't encounter setbacks and difficulties and meet challenges. And we're in a difficult period for the BRICS at the moment, particularly if you compare it with the situation of several years ago. One of the things that was supposed to characterize the BRICS as major developing economies was, of course, that they were enjoying high economic growth rates. If you look at the situation now, albeit with some problems themselves, only two of the BRICS are maintaining relatively healthy rates of growth. That's China and India. The other three are very economically challenged for different reasons, are either just barely managing to sustain growth or are dipping into recession. And above all, we have a situation where two key members of the BRICS alliances, Brazil and South Africa, as you've already mentioned in the case of Brazil, are actually facing largely U.S.-instigated efforts at regime change. In Brazil, that's been successful for now. In South Africa, so far, it hasn't been successful. But the political situation facing the ANC-led government in South Africa is also quite critical. The Chinese press has, in the last week or so, run several articles about China-Russia relations where they've pointed out that the close strategic coordination between China and Russia is, as they've put it, a bedrock of international stability and global peace. And I think the Chinese will be hammering that point home to Russia in the present circumstance. The China-India relationship, from the Chinese point of view, is probably the most problematic of the BRICS relationships. And the U.S. is certainly honing in on that. Donald Trump says he wants to have a very good relationship with India. This is obviously not so much from any great love of India, but it's said with reference to China. It's not so different from what Obama was doing, what George W. Bush was doing, although the Indian government will also be somewhat concerned with the phone call that Trump had with Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, where he said he was a terrific guy and he looked forward to visiting Pakistan, something that Obama has avoided doing, and even hinted possibly that he might want to mediate on the Kashmir question, which is a big red line for the Indian government. India-China relations on the details are very complicated and problematic, related to the Tibet question, the border question, and some nationality questions in India's northeast. But on major issues that concern the countries of the global south, like the terms of world trade, climate change, and so on, India and China coordinate extremely well and have broadly similar positions. It's also the case that the Indian Prime Minister Modi, when he was Chief Minister of Gujarat, was very interested in the Chinese economic model, made a number of visits to China to explore learning from the Chinese economic model, and within his own rather right-wing capitalist framework, Modi's promise of delivery to the Indian electorate is for economic development. And as much as the United States may push, there will be tensions, but I think that Modi, who is a very shrewd political operator, will have no intention of getting too deeply drawn into any U.S. anti-China games, although they'll undoubtedly play with them along with Japan, Australia, and other powers in the region.
David Ewing, that's that's important point. India earlier this week tested its longest range ballistic missile. I believe it's a ballistic missile. In other words, one that has the scope not just of reaching Pakistan, its traditional adversary, but even reaching into China. Certainly the Chinese military and all the people of the region would take note of that. India is not part of the NPT, has developed nuclear weapons, as did Pakistan, outside of the NPT framework. In other words, it's not really under any sort of international supervision. Trump is playing to the BJP, the right-wing Hindu-based ruling party in India. You could see that. But as Keith mentioned, he's also playing to Pakistan, which would be an obvious contradiction to the Pakistani leadership, I mean. I want to ask you, David, about Eurasian geopolitics in general, because obviously the Chinese, while interested and concerned about global politics, are mainly concerned, and you can see this both in their foreign and domestic policy, and what's happening close to China. There is the Eurasian geopolitical orientation that, again, focuses largely on economic development and the Silk Road economic belt. Talk about what that is for China, the importance of that for China.
The Silk Road, yeah, sometimes it's called the One Belt. China is financing and building international pathway from the east all the way to the west as an alternative to the sea routes that the U.S. controls, that the U.S., Britain, and the West controls. So that there are many, Kazakhstan and many of the landlocked countries of Central Asia do not have a way to move oil, do not have a way to move goods, and do not have the capital, internal capital financing, to build up their economic infrastructure. The Chinese bank that been funded to do this entire project across Western Asia, all the way into Europe, and it will benefit all of the major countries in West Asia. India will benefit as well. So it's a decades-long project. The Chinese have invested billions of dollars into the project. They're building ports. They're building highways. They're building high-speed train rail systems. Their plan is to build these systems all the way through Western Asia. So I just think the advantage of being able to move goods on the high-speed rail from Asia to Europe, that's the kind of big thinking that the Chinese are promoting, and they're actually beginning to build the infrastructure now. So this is a strategic challenge to the United States' control of the Pacific routes to reach Western Europe. So it's an alternative. It's another alternative, like a BRIC-type economic alternative. And it's part of a pattern of the developing world, with China's help, creating alternatives to the imperialist domination of the trade routes that we have today.
Keith Bennett, I want to go with that theme a little bit about what the nature is, the character is of China's economic international policy, because their foreign policy is very intertangled with an economic policy. There's the Silk Road, the economic belt. There is, of course, also aggressive Chinese investment in Latin America, very aggressive Chinese investment in Africa, and also an enduring sort of engagement with the Middle East. As China rises, as it becomes the second largest economy in the world, some people on the left, at least inside the U.S. left and perhaps in the European left, see China as another form of imperialism. In other words, another imperialist country that it, as it invests in Africa or the Middle East or Latin America, it does so with the idea of exporting capital with the main goal, the main objective be to maximize profits and domination over the countries where investment is taking place. Do you see China as pursuing, as it carries out this international foreign economic policy, an imperialist policy, or is the model something different?
I think the model is quite different. I'm not saying that there are no left-wing leaders in the oppressed nations who don't have a negative view of China, but I think if you were to, broadly speaking, divide the left on the world scale between the left in the imperialist nations and the left in the oppressed nations, you'll find plenty of people in the imperialist countries on the left with bad things to say about China and comparatively few in the oppressed nations. We know that, for example, that China has extended something like $60 billion worth, quite possibly more, of support to Venezuela. Now, does China simply want to lose all of that money? No, it doesn't. But neither can it be said that China has extended that degree of support to revolutionary Venezuela for purely venal reasons. I think if you look at almost any progressive country in the developing world, they have a very good impression of the rise of China, and they're very pleased with the development of the economic relations between their countries and China. In fact, they want more of it. At the same time, one has to take into account that China is itself still a developing country, even though it's now the second largest economy in the world after the United States, or it's even the first economy in the world in terms of purchasing power parity. Nevertheless, it's a developing country. It's still a country where 55 million people are living in World Bank-defined conditions of poverty, and many others are still very poor. So, yes, China wants to have what they call some win-win results from its economic relations with other countries. Very many of the countries to which China extends aid have considerably higher per capita income than China does itself. And the other point I would make is, of course, one has to understand that there can be a difference between the overall goals of the party and government in China and how they might be implemented by this or that person, and particularly how certain privately owned Chinese companies might behave. You know, there have certainly been well-publicized examples of bad behavior by private Chinese investors overseas, for example, in Zambia. It has to, at the same time, to be said that many private companies treat their own workers in China rather badly from time to time. So there's no particular reason why they could be expected to be held to why they would necessarily uphold a higher standard overseas. Those things have had a certain negative impact on China's relations with other countries, but they don't represent the mainstream of Chinese policy. And the Chinese government, in my view, should crack down a lot harder on some of those people, and I believe they will do in the future.
David Ewing, we have about 2 minutes left. You mentioned the Asian Investment and Infrastructure Bank, the AIIB, which is in many ways the alternative, I would guess, to the IMF, to the Western-dominated IMF or the World Bank. Many countries around the world, most, I believe, who have been invited have joined, including primary U.S. allies in Europe, including Great Britain. The Obama administration tried to dissuade people from joining the AIIB, that bank, that investment bank, but they basically failed. Do you see China's foreign policy in the coming year or years still dominated by this issue of economic development and facilitating economic development? Or do you see a turn towards military or a military-oriented foreign policy as a consequence of Trump? We have about 90 seconds left.
No, I see China as continuing its economic development. And I just think that there's so many imponderables. Here we are at the end of 2016, and there are just so many imponderables about what an giant but unstable country like the United States might end up doing. So I think the surest thing to bet on is that China will do its best to continue to develop its economy. It has to, really has, unlike the U.S., China really has the means to do so. It has plenty of internal growth, and it has the means to develop its economy. And I think for China, military, you know, confrontations are always something that China wants to avoid. China has a deliberate policy of peace, prolonging confrontations and preventing them. And that China's success has been because it's been able to use its economy to develop itself, not to spend money on weapons. So the ineffective expenditures on weapons are something that are holding back the U.S. economy. They are not holding back the Chinese economy.
Right. So even as China improves and modernizes its military, it's a fraction of what the U.S. military budget is. The U.S. spends $1 trillion. That's the real number. $1 trillion a year. That's probably 15 or 20 times as much as what China spends.
China only has to spend on really on defense. The U.S. has to has an aggressive military policy that encompasses the whole world. China can narrow its military spending towards its own defense. And
yeah, we're going to leave it there. China doesn't have those 1,000 military bases all over the world. We've been speaking for the full hour with Keith Bennett. He's a researcher and analyst on Chinese politics and international relations who advises both Chinese and Western companies. We've been talking to him from London. We've been also talking with David Ewing, co-chair of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association in San Francisco. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.